everybody. Today is absolutely one of my most favorite podcasts around. I'm Stu Turley, President and CEO of the Sandstone Group, and welcome to the Energy News Beat. Today, we are interviewing Paula Glover. She is fabulous. She has the podcast Always Bet on Black. We are about to roll out season two of this fabulous podcast. Paula was the past CEO of ABE, the American Association of Blacks in Energy, and now she's the current president over at, Paula, you'll do this. Welcome, Paula, and I am so excited to see you.
Thank you so much for having me, Sue. I'm excited to be here, and I'm so thrilled to see you. We always have fun together when we do stuff like this.
Oh, in fact, Larry, your husband always has to pull us in the corner and say, quit it. You guys are having way too much fun.
Yeah, he does, and I think he relishes being able to do that. So, you know, I have to get better at ignoring him. I haven't gotten there yet, but I'm working on it.
Well, Paula, I want to set the stage just a little bit for folks. And that is, I got to see and listen to almost all of season one of Always Bet on Black. And it was a wonderful, wonderful series of hard-hitting discussions with some fantastic folks. Can you tell me about what you started Always Bet on Black? And what you were thinking when you started bringing in some of these guests?
Yeah, you know, really it was, and it sounds cliche, a bit of a labor of love. When I started it, it was really kind of an idea in my head on how do you create a platform for African-American leaders in energy specifically to talk about their own experiences as leaders and their own journeys. And for me, it was really because what I understood was that I'm actually very lucky that these were all individuals that I had gotten to know in some way. And while I didn't know everyone's complete story, I knew they had stories and thought it was really important for all those individuals in our business who don't get to hear from them, to hear from them, particularly, I think, young people of color who are entering in this industry, who see leaders and know that there may be of challenges, but not necessarily understanding what those challenges were or how they're able to navigate the industry in a way that saw success, how they defined it at the end. And so that really was the point, was just to, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what you've seen and what you've gone through. You know, as you mentioned, Stephen, my previous role, that's what I was always asked to do. But there are others, and my journey is not the same as anyone else's.
No, and one of the things that I really enjoyed about seeing you interview them is taking a nugget. You took that nugget and you drilled down on it. And there were some surprise turns on some of those as they opened up my eyes as far as some of the disparate treatment on them as these people were going up the ladders, being successful. And it was stunning. And I'm so excited to see season two. But Barrett Hedges, I have to tell you, that one was absolutely so fun. In fact, I'm writing in Barrett Hedges 20 to 24 for presidential candidate because I thought his story was so cool. So you've got even a presidential candidate on your season one.
Yeah, I will tell you what, for folks listening, encourage them to listen to everybody. I think all of those interviews are different, but they're good. But Barrett, you know, and sharing for people why it probably resonated with you as it did with me, that his nugget was, you know, people may see you in roles that you don't see yourself in, and trusting that those who know you and see you do and believe you can do something. Sometimes you just need to trust their judgment,
right?
And lean in. And, you know, that certainly resonated with me. I think that's definitional to my own personal journey and career. But the other thing I think about Barrett, which was always so neat, is that you get to see how people aren't one-dimensional because he had multiple careers, right? So he was an energy leader, but, you know, we learned that he was a Texas Ranger. He was in law enforcement. He just had all kinds of things that he had done. And I think that, you know, I think what he was sharing is that that also informed how he led and his journey, even in a corporate environment.
And my respect for him just was so great. And I love meeting them. And people don't understand that. But Paula, tell us a little bit about your upbringing and how that trained you in what you saw because you had to get to Always Bet on Black as a labor of love.
Yeah.
Back up a little bit. How'd you get there?
You know, I'm a New York City girl. I grew up in Queens, New York. And my family, my mom and my brother and sister and I, we moved to Connecticut when I was about 13. But I continued to keep summers in New York because I just didn't really want to be in Connecticut. And I will, you know, let me just be frank. I didn't want to be in Connecticut because I believed at the time I lived in a all Black or majority Black neighborhood, people of color. My next door neighbor, who was my brother's best friend, a kid named Chris Latola. They were the only white family on our street.
Right.
And then we moved to Connecticut and we moved into a community where there were only three Black families in this town. Mm-hmm. We were one of three. And I kept going back to New York because I didn't want to live in a community of all white people. I couldn't figure out how I was going to be able to navigate that. And it's always really interesting. Right. As an adult, when I share that, because for I think a lot of my Caucasian colleagues, they're surprised that someone who's African-American would feel a kind of fear of moving into a white community the way that they might say, you know, I would be fearful of moving into an African-American community. And so being able to say that out loud, that as African-Americans, we, you know, it's what you all as Caucasians may think is easy, may not seem easy to us. It's not an easy thing to navigate. And so I lived in Connecticut and ended up in this business because it was the job that paid me the most. That was why. I had two job offers. The job at the gas company paid $1,000 a year more than the other job. And so I took the job at the gas company.
Nice.
And then really, as I worked, my first job was taking payments from customers and sometimes turning off people's electric gas and turning it on, all that stuff customer related. Yep. And in that, I started to kind of really enjoy the business. And why it really ties to Always Bet on Black, ironically, is I started to meet people like Barrett Hatches. And I started to really, they became friends. And I started to learn so much about them and started to learn a lot about the relationship that different communities have with the energy system and the fact that it is different. And I didn't know that. And Barrett and other colleagues started to kind of educate me and got me interested in understanding how our overall economy and all of the issues, social issues that we see economically from income, income inequality and so on and so forth, has a lot to do with how we interact with the energy system. All of these things are very much related.
Right.
And that became the thing that kept me in energy and really has driven what my passion and interests are, is identifying and understanding why those things happen and then working with industry and policymakers to understand how we can make it different. And I believe that understanding the connectedness of it all is how you can get better policy. Solving problems, in my mind, piecemeal tends to then create another problem on the back end because we haven't looked at everything.
Oh, and you know what amazes me is being able to work with the American Association of Blacks in Energy, working about you were phenomenal with that organization in energy policies. And some of the things I learned is some of the best meaning policies don't always help the people in the disproportionately impacted communities.
Absolutely. I think that's why understanding not only how we got here, but what are all the other issues that are going on is incredibly important. Because otherwise we're trying to throw money and band-aids at something that really requires surgery. And maybe an amputation on occasion. And if we're not looking at all of it, then we are bound to repeat those mistakes. Right.
Yep.
You know, the other things too, that particularly when I was at AIDE, that I love to say and believed wholeheartedly, is that when we think about policy, we should be focusing on the least of us first. Because I just believe that if we focus on those who have the least, everybody else will be okay.
That's fabulous.
That's not what we do. But I believe that if you focus on those who have the least, you'll start to see the rest of us are going to figure it out, as opposed to focusing on those of us who have the most and thinking that, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and they'll figure it out. It's never worked that way. So that's kind of my approach to policy and in the work that I do.
And I saw that in not only everything that you were doing, I saw that in what Abe was doing and industry leadership. And some of the things that in let's take the oil and gas space, they've not always done a great job with ESG. And we know that ESG means environmental, social, and governance. Mm-hmm. And social is left out a lot.
Yeah.
Environmental was left out a lot. What can you say for young folks coming into the energy space? What to look for? How do they get to the next level? And what are your some of your thoughts for the executives looking at trying to stop those old practices?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a meaty and heady question. So we'll start with that. You know, environmental social governance, ESG, I think, is important in that it's starting to drive decisions at many companies, and especially in our industry. Right. I think the thing we all have to be really aware of is that environmental and social have much easier definitions for individuals and companies to kind of rally around, and that social actually isn't well-defined. It means a lot of different things, right? And social right. ESG really is the way that a company, and I think this is Standard & Poor's, I think it's Standard & Poor's definition, but how an organization interacts with the world around it. So how right. does a company interact with its workforce, all of its key stakeholders, all of, it's so right. big. And each audience is very different, right? So right. you have organizations who look at the S in ESG, and they may have a particular focus on what is their corporate giving and engagement in community outreach. And that works, right? That's a part of it.
Right.
Other organizations will say, well, we're going to focus on diversity and that piece. And we're going to focus on, and because there's not, I think, a standard definition that you can measure across organizations on what S actually right. means, it makes it more difficult for companies, but it also makes it more difficult for those of us who are trying to engage with companies, particularly young people who may be looking right. at ESG standards as a measure for them to decide whether or not this is an organization they should want to work for.
Excuse
I think,
me.
Though, for those young people, it's really important, and many of them do it now, right, is to ask the kinds of questions that are going to give you the information that you want about what are those opportunities. I yeah. still believe that this is one of the best industries anybody can work in. And I believe that even in oil and gas, right, there are lots of opportunities to be innovative. There are opportunities to be creative. Yeah. There are opportunities to be a scientist and delve deep in science and research. Yes. There are opportunities to do, you know, business development and create large projects and build stuff and yeah. make stuff. So I think our industry is just so interesting and so massive. And there are tons of opportunities for young people and others to do things. And then I think overarching the handwriting's on the wall. The industry is shifting. Is yep. it shifting as quickly as everybody would like? Maybe not. But I might suggest also that the problems and these massive organizations are doing so many different things that sometimes we actually don't know all that they're doing.
Right.
That does not mean that we should not encourage them to be aggressive, but it does mean that sometimes you got to just take a moment to understand what's happening, right?
You know,
and where their focuses are.
You know, some of your interviews were also talking about diversity and the importance of, or the lack of promotions or the lack of the ability for young people to move up the ladder fairly. And that to me was just like, wow.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. Even in my new organization, we are challenged in that we are not, I think, as organizations, clearly articulating what the pathways yeah. are. And we actually aren't even articulating when there is no pathway. Right. And sometimes there is no pathway. And it's hard to say to somebody, you're doing great and you're awesome. But right. actually, I don't even have a place to move. Right. Because we don't want to lose somebody who we think is a top tier performer. Right. But there are always going to be some kinds of limits. I think with the Always Bet on Black podcast and listening to these leaders kind of talk about pipelines and the importance of pipelines and diversity, mm-hmm. diversity in those pipelines. What I think, Stu, you'll recall, right, in the summer of 2020, as all kinds of organizations were making commitments on racial justice and racial diversity right. and da 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 da. One of the things that the American Association of Blacks in Energy did was issue a statement around equity and what race equity could look like in our business. And I think importantly, what the organization pointed out is that we need to, and I want to use their words, right? We need to put our own houses in order. And so bringing in diverse candidates into organizations that don't have them is a great thing to do. But absent the, I think, my belief is that absent the required introspection as a leader about what your organization looks like, what is that culture? What are our processes? Are we sending the kinds of signals that we should to our existing employees of color that there are opportunities for them and where those opportunities exist and how that all works? In my mind, just bringing in new diverse folks actually doesn't get you much farther than where you already are. And I would also suggest that if we think about how companies had such a huge focus on millennials 10, 12 years ago, really important for them to do, and how they start to think about changing their culture and expectations, right? You have a generation, new workforce generation, who has no plans to work for you for 20 years. That's not going to happen, right? As a Gen Xer, I felt like, wow, none of that interest would seem to be made for those of us. That stinks, but that's the reality of that day.
Right.
But companies figured out how to adjust because they wanted millennials to work for them. And I think companies need to learn how to do just when you want diverse, a greater sense of diversity within your organizations. Because this isn't about people being nice and good to each other. It is about how do we show up authentically at work, which is the other thing that we're asking people to do, right? Show up as yourself and be authentically. Well, when you do that, then what you're really talking about is how do we manage our personalities in such a way that we can be productive as a team? And I think that just requires a different level of focus and work from organizational leaders and really some acknowledgement. You know, what I found in the organization, I'm running the Alliance to Save Energy. And as we've been going through this diversity journey as an organization over the last year, one of the things that we're learning is that we also have diversity. We have shared language. And so for those employees who look like me and have had a similar background, there are things that we talk about, but the language is the same, right? Same slang. We may be, there's something there that jives with us that may not necessarily translate to our other colleagues. And certainly in my position, I need to be aware of how that makes other people feel and make sure that I'm not being exclusive in that shared language. And then also help the other members of the team to see that they may have shared language that makes the rest of us feel excluded, right? We all have some work to do in this.
What you just said, Paula, was missing from so many, as the president of the Alliance to Save Energy, so many executives talk kind of like greenwashing. You know, they'll go out and say, hey, this, we are an ESG company. But what you're saying, it's even difficult as a president who understands diversity to try to go out and enforce diversity. Is that what I just heard?
Yeah. I mean, and it's not even about enforcement, but if I think about some of the interviews we did in Always Bet on Black and other interviews that I did, one of the things that all of these executives said is that I'm not the executive for the Black employees. I'm the executive for all the employees.
Yes.
And that means I have a responsibility, right? Not just for myself and for my team, but to understand how all of this is going to land on a team. And if there are challenges, how do I help folks work through it, provide them resources, whatever is required. And for us at the Alliance, we brought in a culture consultant, someone who actually specializes in organizational culture so that they could help us identify challenges early, help us figure out and think about what's coming next. We had trainings on how do you have a meaningful conversation. We're going to have training on how do you manage your triggers and other people's triggers, because so much of this is about us learning who we are.
What do you mean by a trigger? Because I know what a trigger means to my wife, and that's when I do something really stupid. But what do you mean by a trigger at the job?
When you're having a conflict with somebody, or you're having not even a disagreement necessarily, we could be having a discussion where we're on opposite sides of an issue. And there could be possibly something that you say that is normal for something that's your normal thing, and you say it all the time, that could trigger me, that could really tick me off. And so part of it is, how do I learn to not be mad? because that's my trigger that you are well not aware of, right? So it's not right. Like a marriage where my husband knows what my triggers are. So if he pushes my button, that's intentional. Just as if and when I push his button, I've likely done it on purpose, right? I'm right. very familiar with that. But with your colleagues, they're not going to know that. And so as leaders and as colleagues, we need to understand what our own triggers are so that we can manage them and not get and react. But also we're doing training so that we can understand what other people's triggers are so that we don't push buttons when we don't need to, or we don't use phrases that mean one thing to me, but something to someone else. And now we have, you know, circular talk and disagreement and all that other stuff. And so in my opinion, it has been time well spent focusing on our culture. So that as we increase the diversity in our organization, we've already done that other kind of work. And we can bring people in and give them a sense of safety and belonging as they join our team.
You bet.
Whew, that was a mouthful, Mr. Turley.
I'll tell you what, your confidence, your knowledge, and your sense of accountability is extremely refreshing to me. And you've had that almost, you are genuine no matter where you are. And that to me is a lot that other CEOs could learn from. Instead of being genuine on a camera, how about some accountability that you've already put in by that having that consultant group in saying, hey, how do we go to the next level? How do we not trigger each other? And, you know, I'm such a happy kind of guy. I trigger people just by being happy, and people are not used to that. So I need counseling on how not to trigger people.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I would say thank you for saying that I am so confident. I will tell you, I do all of this because I'm actually not confident. And these tools are as important for me and to me as I think they are for everybody else.
I'm going to call hoo-ha on you here.
You're
right?
Going to call hoo-ha?
I'm going to call hoo-ha. And the reason is you are one of the best interviewers I've had the pleasure of working and producing for. So I don't know how you can say that. I'm sorry. I'm calling hoo-ha.
You call it hoo-ha. All right. Well, look, my coaches, my culture consultant, who also does some coaching with me, she's good at calling hoo-ha on me as well. So I'm not going to be mad at you about that. Okay. I'll take it. But yeah, I mean, I just think, right, being authentic as a leader, and I'm learning this every single day, right? This is a journey for me. And I think the thing that I can contribute is for people to see that it is a journey for me. That I didn't show up this way, and that I work at it every single day.
Oh.
And that is part of my work, I believe, as a leader, and to own my stuff. And so I've had to learn the power of my words.
Wow.
I've had to learn that, right? I've had to learn that just because I may be speaking in a way that I'm not intending to speak as the president, when it left my mouth, I was the president when I said it. And so that's how people received it. And so you have to, like, I had to learn the power of my words and how do I set stage? I had to learn about my own strengths and blind spots. And then how do I articulate that sometimes So sometimes it's adjustment of my own behavior, but sometimes it's like, how do I articulate that this is just who I am? And if it aggravates you, I get it. I just don't know how to turn it up. Right. So and I'll give you an example. One of my things is I love lots of data and information, and I ask lots and lots of questions. And it can be incredibly frustrating when you're trying to push forward to get to the next step.
Right.
Get to the end to have somebody who's constantly asking you questions, and because I am insanely curious.
Right.
And so many times my questions are not intended to stop movement and progress. It's just my own curiosity and wondering. Right. And I read something and you just said this. And I wonder what that is. And so I have to learn to tell the people, I'm not asking questions because I want you to do something different. I'm asking you questions because I'm curious. And then I also have to learn when it's inappropriate for me not to ask a question at all. That sometimes I just can't. I just have to keep that curiosity to myself, because I'm actually dragging back the team.
I bet you were like my daughter.
Yeah, I'm always just kind of like, I'm one of those people that, because I think I read so much different stuff, you know, so when someone says, what's the business novel that you read, the business book that you read to help you improve? I don't have one. But I'm just not that kind of reader. I read tons of stuff. And I can get something from, I don't know where. It could be an article in the Harvard Business Review, but it could be an article in the Washington Post. And it could also be an article on Medium. Like I just, I'm constantly trying to consume information because to my very first point, I'm always trying to connect the dots. And so that's how I do it.
Well, you know, as an industry thought leader in the energy space, you are uniquely qualified to help turn the tide in many ways. And I really believe that your season two of Always Bet on Black is just going to blow through the roof with your leadership and being able to articulate that to people, because it was so cool in season one that I'm just so excited about season two and how far the reach is going to go, Paula. I mean, what are some of the things that your goals are for this year for Always Bet on Black?
I mean, I think, well, the biggest one, right, is to extend the reach, right? I think, and it's to tell the stories. I think, you know, storytelling is important, but I think it's incredibly important in our business because we don't tell stories. We're so scientifically, technologically fact-based that sometimes we forget that there are people at the end of every single thing that we do.
Wow.
No matter what we're doing, there is a person and people who are being impacted by that work. And it doesn't matter what your job is. At the end of the cycle, there are people. And so what I'm excited about for this season is more storytelling, more, you know, connections. And I think for folks who heard the last episode, you know, people hear Always Back. They know that I work in energy. They think the conversation is always focused on energy. And it's a little bit focused on energy, but it's actually more focused on people.
Yes.
And the relationship of energy to people and the people who lead these organizations and how they think about this transition and those questions or challenges that they may have. I have found, I serve on a board and we had a dinner and we did small tables so that we could more intimate and get to talk to each other. And, you know, one of my favorite questions to ask people in those settings is, tell me that thing that keeps you up at night from where you sit. Not what the CEO keeps the CEO up at night, but what keeps you in your organization that you run up at
night? And that question drags out personal stuff that makes your podcast different than others that I got tingles.
I mean, that's this part that's awesome, right? Because the things that people talk and think about are so varied from mental health, and people who say, like, I am incredibly concerned during COVID about my team members who have been home or who are isolated, it could be anything. That's what's so amazing about it and exciting. And, you know, this year, I think we have a really good lineup of people that we're going to be talking to who are going to have different kinds of stories to tell.
And the long friendships that like Barrett and Rick Thinkpig, I mean, he is I enjoy getting to know him through the speakerships that he had did. He doesn't know me from Adam, but I feel like I know him just because I've been listening to everything he does and I'm in the background. But your long-term relationships and your new relationships make an incredible, you make a bond very quickly. And so we're going to start up this. When do you think we're going to start rolling all this out?
According to my executive producer, Larry Glover, this stuff will be rolling out in March. The first episode should hit the airwaves. So we're moving forward. And listen, thank you, because it is truly inspirational when you have an idea that people buy into quickly and then are so open to lending their time and expertise to this thing that was in your head. And at the end of the day, Always Bet on Black was this thing in my head that I said out loud one day to two really special people who decided to make it a thing.
Isn't that great?
It happened. And I probably would have never followed through. I don't even have to say I probably wouldn't have. I would not have followed through on Always Bet on Black had it not been for the encouragement of you guys at Sandstone and my husband and the team at Abe and the fact that you all were like, yeah, we should do this. This is going to be really great. That I was like, oh, okay, then I guess I'll do it. Right. Oh. So lesson for Barrett Hatches. Sometimes people see things in you that you don't see in yourself. That's what happened with Always Bet on Black.
when Barrett wins the election in 2024, I would love to be on his cabinet. I'm sorry, man. I want to follow that man all the way through, and then I'll follow you too, because both of you, you know, we're off and running. And so, Paula, I am so excited about season two, and we're going to have all of your contact. We're going to have your website. We're going to have all of the content in the show notes. And so, again, thank you so much for stopping by. The Energy Newsbeat podcast. We sure appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me, and really looking forward to us working together and doing some great stuff in 2022.
Sounds great, Paula. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
You too.